It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. People and families who rely on Wisconsin's food share program will see a slight increase in benefits in October. The federal government's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP, was updated for the first time since the 1970s to reflect the increased cost in healthy food. This program helps fund the state's initiative. Our next guest joins us to talk about how the boost in benefits will impact Wisconsin families and talk about the state of food insecurity amid the ongoing pandemic. And we want to hear from you. Have you or your family faced food security? Do you know someone who does receive SNAP benefits? And what do you think about this increase? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maureen Fitzgerald is the Vice President of Government Relations for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. It's the largest hunger relief organization in the state, working with more than 400 food pantries, soup kitchens, and meal programs in 35 counties across eastern Wisconsin. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So can you talk a little bit more about what we know of the increase in SNAP?
So what we're seeing is for the first time in 45 years, so this is a long time in coming, the USDA is reviewing a metric that they use to determine the maximum SNAP benefit. So basically they're looking at how they can put together a market basket at low cost for a family of four, and then that helps decide the maximum SNAP benefit.
Do you have a sense as to why it has taken, 40, 50 years to increase these SNAP benefits or to retool the metric that they use? Because a lot has changed between the 1970s and 2021.
It really has. And when you think about how much more sophisticated we are about nutrition, and frankly, how we eat is very different, right? The metric when they started in the 1970s really takes into consideration, hours and hours of cooking family meals, which is really not sort of how families eat today. This came out of the 2018 Farm Bill. So the USDA was directed by the bipartisan Farm Bill that came out of 2018 to review this program for the first time. And they put in some additional considerations that the USDA had to look at, which resulted in this new metric that came out in August.
Can you talk a little bit more about, that new information that you just mentioned that they really started seriously looking at to get to where we are today?
So they're really looking at the cost of food, about how people cook food, and how people consume food. So they're sort of looking at different metrics that they haven't really considered in the past. So instead of requiring families to have dry beans, right, that might take additional preparation, they're looking more at fresh fruits, at dairy, at the way people actually consume food now. So for the first time in 45 years, they're redoing this, which is exciting. But it really is working out to a very modest increase for people. It's going to be about 40 cents a meal.
We are talking to Maureen Fitzgerald, Vice President of Government Relations for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. We are talking about an increase in SNAP benefits. That's the federal program that helps fund food share here in Wisconsin, and how that's going to impact families in the state. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And I want to get back to the impact of the increase, because per person, you're going to see a slight uptick in how much people are getting. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So SNAP is the single largest anti-hunger program in the United States. It helps people put food on their table. So in Wisconsin, if you look at the food share program, it's about 780,000 people that are on that program. And the majority of that, so over 50%, are children. And so this really helps families put food on the table. This increase is going to go into effect October 1st. And like I said, it's going to be a modest increase. So you're going to see about 40 cents per meal. But what we're really looking at is how this intersects with some pandemic increases that happened to the program. So there are a lot of headlines right now that are saying, this is an enormous increase to the program. It's going to change, I've seen headlines that said 30% increase in the program. The reality is that there's a pandemic program that increased the benefit that's ending at the end of September, and this new program will begin October 1st. So people will see a slight change, but it's not going to be enormous change to their benefit.
Well, with that in mind, if it's not, as big as maybe some of the headlines are saying, is it enough for families in Wisconsin?
I mean, food share has always been created to be a supplemental program, so it's always supposed to help people get by. But the reality is that it runs out, right? And so people not only need food share, but they also rely on emergency food, and many times run out of food by before the end of the month. And the concern always is we don't want seniors having to choose between buying food and buying medicine, or for children not to have enough food to eat when they go to school. And so what we want to make sure is this benefit is something that is going to sustain families and provide the nutrition that the family needs.
Now we're in a much different place in 2020, 2021 than we were in 2018 when they started looking at these metrics. Can you talk about how the pandemic has affected food insecurity in Wisconsin?
I think that's the exact lens we need to be looking at, right? Because a lot of this is coming out because this started in the 2018 Farm Bill. We didn't know what was coming, and we didn't know how food insecurity was going to be impacted through the pandemic. For Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, we're the largest food bank in the state of Wisconsin. We provided 81% more food during 2020 than we did in 2019. So we just saw a huge increase in people, many people who have never needed emergency food before, people who had needed to ask for help for the first time. And we're still coming out of that. For 2021, we're seeing about a 29% increase in childhood hunger. So one in five children in our footprint are in need of assistance with food. And I think that is something that we're going to experience for the next while, right? I think we're still experiencing the pandemic. I think we all want to put it behind us, but we know that we're not out yet, right?
Yeah, we're not out of the woods yet, and there's so many things that have been impacted by COVID-19, and we'll probably see a ripple effect for a long time. Now, we are talking about the increase in SNAP benefits set to go into effect in October. We're also discussing food insecurity in Wisconsin. Our guest is Maureen Fitzgerald, Vice President of Government Relations for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. And of course, you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about recent changes to the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP and formerly known as food stamps, and also how it could benefit Wisconsin families. Our guest right now is Maureen Fitzgerald. She's the Vice President of Government Relations for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, and we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts or questions on the increase? Is it a good idea? Is it long overdue? Call in now, 800-642-1234. And I'm going to go to one of our callers right now. We have George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And hi, Maureen. This is George, and I run a food pantry in downtown Milwaukee. And I have to compliment Feeding America for what they did, especially during the pandemic, because we went from feeding about 1,300 people a month to almost 4,000 to 5,000 people at one point during the pandemic. And if it wasn't for Feeding America, we would not have been able to feed our guests. So thank you very much. My main concern is the increase is very minimal, but what is the real problem in Milwaukee too is the food deserts, where people just cannot get to places that have affordable, healthy foods. Maureen, I would just like to see if you want to address that and what can be, you know, what's being done with that.
George, thank you so much for that call. And thank you for the work that you're doing, George. Food deserts have been a problem for a really long time. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I completely agree with George. And I would also echo that it's really the work of people at food pantries doing miraculous work, particularly during the pandemic. I was joking the other day where we're all just looking at each other and saying, how tired are you?
Yeah.
you know, I think food deserts are something that are an enormous concern to people who work in this space. And I think it's something that we're constantly working at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin to make sure that we can provide healthy food to people all throughout our community. We are located in the heart of Milwaukee, so we understand this issue really acutely. One thing I would say, and I think something that's being addressed right now, is getting food to people in need everywhere in our community. So thinking about where the pantries are and how we can increase pantries in areas where there is not a presence right now, and also providing healthy foods through farmers markets and through incentive programs that will double up people's farmers markets dollars as they go in and use their food share at farmers markets. So there, I think there's a lot of discussion around that, particularly in the city of Milwaukee. We know that a lot of cities received American Rescue Funds funds, and what they're doing with that is really thinking about how are we going to get access to healthy food to people in need in our community. And I think a lot of innovative solutions are coming in. We're having a lot of discussions, not only with the city of Milwaukee, but with the county, and thinking really creatively about how we can get food to people who may be homebound, who may not have access to a big box grocery store, who may not have access to a food pantry, and thinking about how we can provide food to those people in need. So it's a huge concern, and I think a lot of work is being done in that area.
George, again, thank you so much for that call. We're talking to Maureen Fitzgerald, Vice President of Government Relations at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. And I'm going to go back to our callers right now. We have Teresa in Fond du Lac.
Thank you so much for the work that you do for Feeding America. Just a couple tips that I, you know, wanted to share. One, you know, people really need to kind of meet us halfway here and cook with produce and fruits that are in season. Stock up a little bit, roll up your sleeves, learn how to cook from scratch. It's healthier, it's more economical. And, you know, it would be great if, and I don't know if SNAP already does this, but handing people out a little pamphlet of meals that you can make for your family, meals you can modify that everybody would enjoy. Another thing is, if you can, grow a garden. I know it's work, but it's so rewarding when you can produce your own fruits and vegetables.
Teresa, thank you so much for that call. Teresa has some suggestions. What are your thoughts?
So I would say that that is exactly what's happening at the USDA, is that they are revamping recipes and handouts for people based on this new Thrifty Food Plan. So that's in the works right now. There's a program called SNAP Ed, which actually provides nutrition education. The UW Extension is a great partner in SNAP Ed, and they provide healthy recipes at low cost for people. And I'm sure they're thinking about this new change and what that means and how to get that information out to people. And one other thing I would say is, with SNAP or Food Share, as we call it in Wisconsin, you can buy not only go to the farmer's market and buy fresh produce, you can actually buy seeds and grow gardens in your home. So one of the things that a lot of people don't understand with Food Share is that you can buy seeds and then grow your own produce.
And I just have a follow-up question, which is, you know, this sort of healthy cooking does take time. Are there any tips out there for really busy families who are on SNAP to be able to accomplish that? Maybe cut out some steps to make it a little easier?
I think one of the things that, I mean, there have been a lot of studies about how people eat that receive SNAP versus people who don't receive SNAP. And the reality is that we all kind of eat the same, right? And that I think one of the pushes that we have to consider is that I think people with difficulty with lack of transportation or what we were just talking about with food deserts, there may be more difficulty getting to access to healthy food. And I think just given work schedules, right? If you're working in multiple jobs and trying to get food on the table, you may not have time to, you know, cook from scratch. It's a great thing. I love the suggestion, but it just may not be the reality for a lot of people. So there are definitely recipes out there to help people make healthy meals faster, basically, sort of living the way we all do.
Teresa, again, thank you so much for that call. I'm going to go back to our callers. We have John in Eau Claire right now. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have two comments. Number one, it seems to me that over the years, the number of food items that are accessible through food stamps has increased to the point where people are buying convenience foods, unhealthy foods. And the program was started giving people an opportunity to buy basic food things to help in preparing food at home. The other concern I have is that we now have basically two generations of parents in this country who have gotten used to being dependent upon the government to feed their children. What happened to the responsibility of people, children into the world to feed their children? That should be their first priority of the day, is to feed their children. And we have a huge swath of people, especially in our cities, that that have become dependent on government, and they've lost track of the responsibility of being a parent. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for that call, John. So hearing a lot there, just with how long the program has been in effect and, you know, the access to it. What's your response?
Sure. The reality for FoodShare is that most people are not on the program very long. So FoodShare is actually a program that people are sometimes on and off, right? So they may come in on the program and then leave the program when they get a job or when they go back to school or whatever is happening in their lives. So FoodShare is a program that many people use as something to get, tide them over when they're in need. But I would also say that I work with families every day, and I am very proud of how difficult it is for people to not only ask for help. I think Wisconsin, we're proud people, and it's difficult to ask for help. So I think when parents step forward and say, hey, we need a little extra help to make sure that our children are eating healthy, that is something that we should applaud and not judge, because you never know when you're going to need help. I can't tell you how many people every year tell me, I used to come to the food pantry and now I volunteer at the food pantry. Or I used to be on FoodShare and now I tell people about the program because it helped me through, right? We have congresswomen, we have elected officials, we have business leaders that used FoodShare to get through tough times and to move forward. I had a parent recently tell me in Milwaukee, they lost food because of the power and they didn't have money to replace the food that they lost in the refrigerator. And they were trying to save some of the spoiled food and feed their family with the spoiled food in their refrigerator. I think in a great state like Wisconsin, we can do better and make sure that all our children have healthy food.
Thanks again for that call, John. I'm going to go back to our callers. We have Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I would like the guest to talk about individuals who are elderly and unable to cook, perhaps. I would like them to talk about people who are disabled and are single but living on their own, who have disabilities that prevent them from being able to cook but would use frozen food, and who most of those may be unable to also plant gardens. So I'd like to hear some discussion about our millions of singles who need the food share, but have unique needs. Thank you.
Nancy, thank you so much for that call. And Maureen, we have about a minute left, a little less than a minute. What's your response?
So about 40% of people, of families who are in food share have a member who is either elderly, blind, or disabled. And one of the fastest growing populations that are receiving food share are seniors. And what we know about seniors on food share is they frequently receive the minimum amount of food share. And that, after the pandemic, is going to be about $20 a month, which is not enough. Right. And so seniors are often struggling. I think one of the good things about the Thrifty Meal Plan is taking into consideration how people are able to cook and thinking about seniors who might not have time. So you're 100% right that there are many, many seniors who use this program, many who don't because they think they're taking away from other people.
Maureen, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Maureen Fitzgerald is the Vice President of Government Relations for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. She joined us on the program today to talk about an increase in SNAP benefits going into effect in October. Coming up next, we'll learn more about an Atlantic Ocean current that could be in trouble. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to an audience question about art.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from listener Chris Murphy from Madison.
My question is, why are there a higher concentration of outsider artist environments in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the U.S.?
Great question. WPR's Tim Peterson asked a few experts to answer Chris's question.
Nick Engelbert's Grandview in Hollandale, Wisconsin. The Paul and Matilda Wegner Grotto in Monroe County. These are some of Wisconsin's artist-built environments. Ornate, meticulously assembled artworks on a massive scale using concrete, glass, auto parts, you name it. Here's Courtney Anderson Kramer, PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, who researches concrete sculpture gardens in the Midwest, like the Wisconsin Concrete Park in Phillips.
In general, a outsider art environment is going to be a space that is an artwork that is monumental in terms of its size and the amount of time that took to make, but also it can be monumental in the number of parts. So we're talking about the Wisconsin Concrete Park. Well, there are hundreds of sculptures on this site that the artist Fred Smith created over the course of decades.
Anderson Kramer says another example that was really influential on other artists in the region is the Dickeyville Grotto.
It is a monument to patriotism as well as Catholicism, and it is a sort of architectural grotto shrine that is encrusted with everything from geodes and rocks to Ford gear shift knobs, and the texture of the space is just stunning. It's like walking into a gem. It's beautiful.
Laura Bickford is an associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Art Center. She says this genre, like any art, is a cultural contribution and worthy of preservation.
These sort of art environments, I like to think of them as a genre-busting genre, where they're really made by people across walks of life who ordinarily maybe wouldn't feel that they were able to make works of art or wouldn't have access to a museum. And so they can really speak to a true way of the way that people are living on the land that they're living on.
And in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin, in the early 20th century, people wanted to share their truth in the medium of concrete. And here's Anderson Kramer again.
At this time, you know, the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s, people are going, they're getting a bag of cement, and they're creating a garden border. They're creating a bird bath. They're creating bird houses out of concrete. So it's very much a part of gardening itself, using the concrete in the garden to make your garden beautiful. It just so happens that these artists really were bitten with the concrete bug and just continued to grow in their confidence, creating sculptural spaces, architectural spaces, adding concrete to their homes.
But is Wisconsin a leader in this type of art? Anderson Kramer says there's not really a concrete answer.
There's some truth and some not so truth to that. You can find these sorts of artworks anywhere in the world, but there are organizations in the Midwest, especially in the state of Wisconsin, like the Kohler Foundation, that has done a great job of taking care of these sites. But then there is some truth to it that there are a lot here, and that's owing to tourism at the time. You think of around the 30s and 40s when these are being made, we're seeing lots of tourism to the Dells, to Door County, and homeowners are kind of capitalizing on this traffic, creating artworks that are driving people to their homes.
Laura Bickford says downloading the map called Wandering Wisconsin is great for navigating to these sites. Though, she admits, the best way to find them is to never take the highway.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on outsider art in Wisconsin, and a longer segment aired on WPR's Central Time. And that story idea? Well, it came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
There are a lot of factors that impact our climate, including ocean currents. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. And we're talking about the health of one of the most crucial ocean currents in the world, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, excuse me. Recent studies show that this current is weakening, and that could have a really dramatic effect on our weather systems. And we want to hear from you. What do you want to know about the ocean's current around the world, how it impacts our weather and our climate? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Of course, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Lifka Cesar is a postdoctoral researcher at Maynooth University in Ireland. She received her doctorate from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. Lifka, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, good morning.
So you're an expert in AMOC. Many of us have never heard about it, but it has a really big impact on life on Earth. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, of course. So basically, the AMOC is a large system of ocean currents that connect the Southern Ocean with the North Atlantic. To kind of draw a picture of it, you have to picture basically a flow of warm and salty water near the surface that is coming from the South Atlantic through the tropics towards the subpolar North Atlantic. And there the water releases heat to the colder atmosphere. And as cold water is denser than warm water, this leads to a sinking of the water masses to deeper ocean layers where they form the southward return flow of the AMOC, which is then flowing from the north back to the South Atlantic. And it is this flow of surface waters, of warm surface waters in, and the flow of cold deep water out of the North Atlantic that leads to a redistribution of heat by the AMOC. It transports heat from the tropics to the high northern latitudes, and we're talking about a lot of heat energy here. So the maximum northward heat transport sums up to about 1.3 petawatts. And to give you an idea, this is approximately the energy produced by a million medium-sized nuclear power stations.
Wow. So that is a huge amount of energy happening as part of this circulation system that's happening in our ocean. You know, when we think about our oceans, it just sort of feels like they're a static bit of water that maybe has waves, but is definitely moving. As you said, this huge amount of water around in not just the Atlantic, but everywhere else. So can you talk about, do we know about the origins of these currents?
Sure. So basically, when we talk about ocean currents, we can say that we have three main drivers. We have, of course, the tides, which are basically driven by the moon. And we have wind-driven currents. I guess also easy to understand, when you have a lot of wind above the water, this can actually move the water. And then, and this is the most important driver of the AMOC, we have so-called density-driven currents. Basically, ocean water, or the density of ocean water, is set by both its temperature, with colder water being denser than warm water, and by its salinity, with salt water being denser than fresh water. And when you have differences in density, then the water will flow from the denser region to the less dense region. And this is the main driver of also what is called the thermohaline, which comes thermo from temperature, and haline is basically salinity circulation. And the AMOC is this part of the thermohaline circulation in the Atlantic. And it's just, it's a huge system. So the transport of the AMOC is about 20 million cubic meters of water per second. That's huge. It's about 100 times the size of the world's largest river, the Amazon River. And yeah, you can just imagine that such a huge system has to have an enormous impact on the world's climate.
We are talking to Livka Sisar right now. She's a postdoctoral researcher at Maynooth University. She's talking with us about this massive current in the Atlantic Ocean. And new studies have found that it could be slowing down and weakening. Now, let's go to that, Livka, right now, which is you've been studying, you know, what's happening. You've been looking at different, you know, the salinity in the water and comparing it to other records. What is going on? Do you have a sense about what is happening with this AMOC?
Yeah. So basically, maybe I should start by telling you why we kind of also started looking into that. So all of our climate models basically predict that the AMOC will weaken over the course of the 21st century due to global warming. And the reason is that basically one of the drivers of the AMOC is this sinking of water in the subpolar North Atlantic from the surface to deeper ocean layers. And we know that this will be interfered with under global warming, because under global warming, we have so much fresh water that is entering the subpolar North Atlantic from the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, from the melting of the Arctic sea ice, but also from enhanced precipitation. And this fresh water makes the surface waters in the subpolar North Atlantic less dense and kind of hinder this sinking of water masses, and therefore the driver of the AMOC. Now, we know that the Greenland ice sheet has been melting for quite some time, and also the Arctic sea ice is reaching very often record low values if we look at it over the course of the last decades. So this kind of makes us wonder, did the AMOC already start to slow down? And to answer this question, it's really difficult, because ideally we would of course just have our instruments that measure the AMOC and tell us what its strengths look like. But due to the size of the AMOC, as I said, spanning the whole length of the Atlantic, the whole width of the Atlantic, which is a few thousand kilometers, you cannot really measure it that easily. And there are some measurement instruments in place right now. They have been installed approximately in 2004. But for everything that happened before 2004, we have to look at other climate parameters, which we call proxy data, that are linked to the AMOC and can therefore tell us what might have happened before 2004. And we did do that. We looked at a lot of different proxies that are somehow associated with the strength of the AMOC. And we found that basically all of them indicate that the mean strength of the AMOC has been weakening over the last approximately 1,600 years, which is as far as our proxies go back, and is now, so the mean state of the AMOC now is weaker than ever before in this time period.
We are talking about the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, better known as AMOC, and its impact on our climate. New research has shown that it has been weakening over time. Our guest is Livka Sisar, a postdoctoral researcher at Maynooth University in Ireland. And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We continue our conversation about a crucial ocean current which circulates warm water from the Gulf of Mexico and cycles cold water south from the northern part of the Atlantic Ocean. New studies show that this current is weakening and has been weakening for some time, but it could have some significant impacts on our climate. Our guest right now is Lífka Sisár, a postdoctoral researcher at Maynooth University in Ireland, and we want to hear from you. Were you scared by the movie The Day After Tomorrow? What questions do you have about what is fact and fiction from the movie? That's where you probably came across this Gulf Stream a while ago. Are you worried about climate change? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, we were just talking about this AMOC system slowing down and that it has been for a while, but it's still going to have pretty significant consequences on our climate, or they're expected to. Can you talk a little bit about what we might see?
Yes, I'd like to add here first that this is still an area that is under investigation, and I guess we don't know yet everything that might happen, but there are a lot of studies that indicate that there would definitely be a strong impact on both the natural and the human system. One of them is, for example, that a weaker AMOC can lead to a decrease in the marine productivity in the North Atlantic. We know from studies that it will likely lead to more and enhanced winter storms coming from the North Atlantic towards Europe. Another consequence is a weakening of the African and the Asian monsoon system, actually, which is really important, of course, for the people there, because it affects where rainfall will happen or where droughts might be expected. So there are really a lot of potential impacts of a weaker AMOC all around the globe. For the US, we know that a weaker AMOC is actually linked to an increase in the regional sea level rise along the US East Coast, which is basically because, and I'm explaining this because this is one of the examples that it's kind of more easy to understand. This northward surface flow of the AMOC that I explained as part of the AMOC leads to a deflection of water masses to the right in the North Atlantic, so away from the US East Coast, which is basically just due to the Earth's rotations, the Coriolis force, which diverts moving objects, which are moving in the north-south direction, such as the current of the AMOC, to the right in the Northern Hemisphere. And as the current slows down, this affects this diversion to the right is weakening, and more water can pile up along the U.S. East Coast, leading to an enhanced sea level rise there.
We are talking to Lífka Sisár right now. She's a postdoctoral researcher, and we're talking about this Atlantic current that new studies show is weakening, and they're still monitoring that. I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Jim in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Morning. Thank you. I think you already answered the one about storms, but I'll ask it anyhow. I have three questions. How is this going to affect the microbiota that supports marine life? The second one, will it affect the jet stream at all? Does it have any influence on the changes in the jet stream? And thirdly, I think you already answered it, but storms that are created in the Atlantic, do they kind of follow this AMOC?
Jim, thank you for those questions. You know, Lífka, let's go with his second question, which was about the Gulf Stream. Do you have any information there?
About the jet stream, I think, right?
That's what I meant. Yes, jet stream.
yeah, that's actually a really good question. So, I mean, I guess most people know that the jet stream is the strong band of winds in the higher altitudes over the Northern Hemisphere, which is also the reason why when you fly from the US towards Europe, you're much faster than the other way around, because you can kind of use this jet stream speed. And it's really important in setting where the high and low pressure systems over the mid-latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere are, therefore affecting also the weather systems. And yes, there is a link towards to the AMOC, but it is a little bit complicated, and we don't know for sure yet how all the implications are. So on the one hand side, the strength of the jet stream is linked to the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar region. So with a stronger temperature gradient, a stronger temperature difference between the two regions, leading to a stronger jet stream. And at least regionally for the Atlantic, the AMOC, of course, has a large part in setting this temperature difference because it transports so much heat towards the polar region. So if the AMOC slows down, then this temperature difference can actually increase because less heat is transported towards the north. And then we have a cooler polar region, warmer tropics, and that could increase the strength of the jet stream. But of course, we always have to look at the jet stream will develop not just by what the AMOC does, but what happens overall in global warming. And there, of course, right now we see a lot of warming in the polar regions. And the other thing is that the exact position of the jet stream, how its waves are basically set it up and where the high and low pressure systems are, that depends also on the temperature difference between the land and ocean in the mid latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. And this can be affected by the AMOC as it affects the sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic. And there is one study that linked the 2015 heat wave in Europe, for example, to the weaker AMOC that year, kind of because the AMOC being weak that year set or led partly to, or was part of the reason why the temperatures in the subpolar North Atlantic that year were particularly cold. And that kind of forced the form of the jet stream to be in such a way that allowed it a lot of warm air coming from the south towards Europe. But it's not the only thing that affects the wave pattern of the jet stream. So yeah, to put it short, yes, there is a link, but it's complicated and affected by also a lot of other factors happening in the climate system.
And thank you for that call. Now, Liefke, you know, you're doing this research now, you're monitoring the AMOC, you're working with other scientists. What are you all kind of on the lookout for over, say, the next 5 or 10 years?
Oh, so basically, we are interested in, of course, what is happening to the AMOC over the next 5 to 10 years. And also, can we identify any kind of early warning signal that gives us an idea of what will happen in the next decades of the AMOC? I mean, when we talk about the AMOC or ocean systems in general, we are normally thinking on longer timescales because the ocean being so huge and having such a large heat capacity, much more than the air, it normally acts on slower timescales than the atmosphere. And so we're kind of course, we know and we expect that overall, over the course of the next century, the AMOC will continue to weaken. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to weaken each year continuously. You know, it's a climate system. It shows natural variability. So we always have to be careful about what the data of a single year or even just 5 years tells us. But we're kind of trying to understand more, are there any shifts that we can see in the circulation system?
Well, Liefke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Liefke Cesar is a postdoctoral researcher at Maynooth University in Ireland. She's studying how the system of Atlantic Ocean currents affects the Earth's climate and whether a major one could be slowing down and the effect that it could have. Just ahead, Summerfest is back after getting canceled last year due to COVID-19. We'll talk about this year's lineup and what people can expect if they attend the festival. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.